Yes, thank you for the kind invitation. I was told that, amongst others, my presentation had to focus also partly on water. It's rain is pouring down now, but I'm also, if I recall, the first time we met when we did the hike in Skarvik. Then we also passed by at Muraske, the little swamp in Skarvik. I also happen to close to where I live, there is also in Muraske a swamp which has kind of a particular history, which I want to link to the idea of granting legal rights or recognizing is not really the same. Legal rights to ecosystems, to nature, to species. And I just want to use the example as a tool, as an instrument to raise some questions and paradoxes related to the topic of legal personhood, assigning legal personhood to ecosystems, which is a relatively recent trend nowadays, implemented in countries in the global south like Ecuador, Colombia, amongst others, who have implemented this idea of granting or recognizing the rights of nature in a more holistic approach to recognizing a more holistic approach to nature, which is linked to indigenous people's view, how they view nature, as they see themselves as a part of nature, which is then set apart from or clearly is distinguished from our so-called Western view on nature, which we instrumentalize nature and we set ourselves outside of nature. So that's a bit the background. And as by means of introduction, I want to introduce you to this swamp. This is a picture that I took in 2018. So this is the church of St. Martens Lennik. I live next to the church. So it's really, in Dutch, we would say een moeras onder de kerktoren, which is relatively novel in some ways, because you don't have that a lot in Flanders, the vicinity of a swamp nearby the center of a village. Because in Flanders we have the tendency to, well, this urban fragmentation, urban sprawl. But here you still have had the swamp. And when I came to live in Lennik in 2006, this area was already a bit rewilded. Of course, I came to live in Lennik in 2006. I wasn't really aware of the history of the area. Later I've been told that it used to be a cropland. It does, of course, has also an owner. It's property. It's somebody's property. But he, for different reasons, decided no longer to use it as a cropland because it was too swampy. Basically, he tried to drain it during the 70s. So there are drainage pipes in the ground of the area. The area is located next to a stream. You don't see the stream. The stream is in the back, where the stream is it used to be more like with meanders, and but now it's one straight stream, as we often see in Flanders and also elsewhere in Europe. But nevertheless, the swamp was there when I came to live in Lennik. By accident, one could say, because the owner decided no longer to use it as a cropland. You can also receive subsidies from the Common Agricultural Policy if you do no longer use your cropland. You decide to rewild your area. But as you see, the size of the trees already indicates that it's been 10, 15 years that the area has been like this. This is how the area looked like in... it's taken from a different angle, by the way, in the summer of 2018. So basically, you could argue that this swamp was a common because it was accessible. I just walked straight through it. It was really nice, bit of wild experience, but nice. There were trees, so you get shade. It was not a public park, but it was accessible. especially because it was so closely located to the village center. And this is what happened in a very warm, hot, dry summer. It's no longer exceptional, even though rain is pouring down, of 2018. So the owner decided to, raise it to the ground, all the nature that was there. And he also decided to, here you see it from a different angle, the swamp was somehow resilient. You see, it even in that dry summer, it was that wet in some parts that it could not, remove all the vegetation that was present there. Of course, this was done by very, with big machines, as you can see. It happened in one day. All of a sudden, it was totally gone. So, that's another. So that's the swamp. The swamp. And so, what did I do then? Because swamps are legally protected in Flanders, so I issued a complaint, and so the nature inspection decided to pursue the claim, and he was so forced to stop his destructive activities. And later you will see some pictures of how the swamp has evolved since then. But the swamp as a concept is also interesting because it reminds us of how we approach nature. Because we see swamps basically throughout the history of mankind as something that needs to be dominated. Civilization basically is almost a contradiction with a swamp, because a swamp is somehow accessible, but also you can get lost in it. You can even drown in it. It's, you cannot define it. Weird people live there. Armies are defeated by the usage of swamps. Hannibal used swamps when defeating the Romans in some instances. The Germans were not able to capture Jewish prisoners in a swamp in Belarus. Partisans hit 10,000 of Jews in a swamp in Belarus. And why? Because the German army could not access that area without rendering themselves very vulnerable. A swamp in the area of Kiev, was flooded again in order to protect the city. So swamps are sometimes interesting, but we tend to see them as something that needs to be dominated. And this person, and you recognize him, or
no.
At least somebody should recognize him from this audience. The previous speaker, it's Mussolini. It's Mussolini, and where is this picture taken? In a swamp. Do you know which swamp? I will not repeat it, but it's the pond. If you translate it in English, it's the Pontine marshes. You've been there, perhaps? It's an area close to Rome. It used marshlands infested with malaria as well. Romans tried to drain it. The popes tried to drain it, but they didn't succeed. And the only person that succeeded was this guy. He made, and you could also, to some extent, because it's not exceptional that dictators are keen on draining swamps. Trump, his famous quote was, "I want to drain the swamp." Washington, the political meddling, the negotiation, the lobbying in Washington. This quote is not a coincidence. Also, Madeleine Albright noted it at some point, that there is a clear link between this rhetoric and of Trump and Mussolini. And I agree with it to some extent, because another example is Saddam Hussein. The Garden of Eden was located in Mesopotamia, as we all know. It was a swamp to some extent. In the swamps in Mesopotamia, that's the cradle of civilization to some extent. A lot of stories, old stories, are situated there. What did he do at some point in the 80s? He wanted to drain a part of these Mesopotamian swamps because there were some tribes that were not in his control. So draining a swamp is kind of, to some extent, pretty illustrative for, you could say, a fascist approach to nature. It's we want to control, we want to dominate it. And so Mussolini was very proud of his achievement, even though I don't know how many workers died because of the malaria in the swamp. He was very proud, and I think even in Italy, people are proud about this achievement. I'm not saying about, but this achievement is not viewed in a negative frame, I guess. But so swamps, if you approach it more as a metaphor, are also interesting to see how we approach nature and how many extremes there are when we talk about approaching nature. So the question is, apparently swamps have done rights in Belgium, because we can stop the draining of a swamp to some extent. That might sound odd to talk like this about nature. Eh? We don't say this swamp has rights. We merely say the swamp vegetation is protected. That's why, and you see, you will notice it on the picture, we now have a rectangular swamp. This is how we lawyers approach nature. We make a distinction between what is protected under the law, the swamp vegetation, and the grassland, which is bordering the swamp, is not protected in agricultural land. So you'll see what the result of that is. We end up with a rectangular swamp. But we never talk about the swamp having certain intrinsic rights. You could say that's normal because our instrumentalist approach to nature has learned us to set ourselves outside of nature, to position ourselves outside of nature. So it's rather odd to then grant or recognize that a swamp has certain rights. It's not that odd if you take into account that in the Middle Ages, and I'm not saying that I have a negative view on the Middle Ages, witch trials took place after the Middle Ages, by the way, but in the Middle Ages and at the 15th, 16th century, you had these animal trials. Animals didn't have rights, but they did have duties. They were tried in court. Yeah, but it's a fact that there were animals. There were even lawyers specialized in defending locusts, donkeys, pigs. What happened? Pigs were strolling around in the village. Some pigs attacked a small boy. It was hurt. Some boy died. And, of course, somebody needed to stand trial. So animals had certain duties. Locusts destroying crops, which gave rise to very difficult debates in the court, because, I mean, God also created nature. So how can you argue that these locusts are to be held accountable if they are created by the same God that created man? So just to give you an illustration, at some point throughout our history, we accepted to some extent that animals had certain duties, didn't have rights. Recently, I mean, we see if we see the strength of granting legal personhood to a river. The Whanganui River in New Zealand was granted legal personality in a law. It was kind of a compromise between the result of long-standing negotiations between Maori and the New Zealand government. They considered themselves to be expropriated by the English when they arrived there. And so this is the result of 100 years of negotiations, by the way. And the Maori are now to be considered as the guardians of this river. The river is not expropriated, and the riverbed, to be clear, but it is being recognized that this river has a legal personality, and there is a kind of guardianship mechanism that can act on behalf of the river. Ecuador has gone one step beyond that. They have included in their reform of their constitution the intrinsic right of nature to exist and to flourish, Pachamama. And now in the recent years, you also see cases, lawsuits in which projects are effectively being blocked with reference to this provision of the constitution. The Colombian Supreme Court, so not a lower court, really the Supreme Court in some case, had in a kind of I mean, it was not really even us by the youth that had started this climate lawsuit, but amongst others, it stated that the Amazon River and the ecosystem has an intrinsic right to exist. And in Spain, they are now considering the recognition of legal rights for a certain lagoon which is threatened by pollution. So why not? I mean, if we grant legal personhood to companies, why not grant it to ecosystems or nature? So it's interesting if you think about it. I mean, of course, you need to make a distinction between granting legal personhood and granting substantive rights to nature. You can grant legal personality, so then the nature can be represented in court. But that's not the same as saying that nature can, under no circumstances, be destroyed. So you can grant legal personality, but I mean, in Ecuador, it's not only about legal personality. They also stated that nature needs to be observed, needs to be preserved, and also restored when damaged. So that's one step beyond that. Especially when this is recognized in the constitution, it can make major difference in the outcome of legal cases in courts, because the constitution, of course, has to be taken into account by judges when interpreting also lower legislation. It needs always to be understood in view of the constitution. But still granting legal rights or recognizing legal rights to nature is interesting, because the first question, of course, is what is nature? If you look to the constitution in Ecuador, yeah, granting rights to nature. Is that tree also part of nature that is standing outside there? Well, who would say yes? Most seem convinced that it's nature. But if we grant rights to nature in our constitution, can we then, is this tree to stay there forever? Is that what we see as nature, or is it, I mean, this is a picture of the swamp during fall. This is, perhaps we might say, yeah, okay, some bit more pristine outlook. It's more nature as we see it, mountains, rivers, lagoons. Is it only pristine nature we want to preserve? Or is it also urban nature? An area that you leave untouched, in, like the Frisch, the, how is it called again, the Frisch de Josaphat? Is that also nature? It wasn't there 100 years ago, perhaps, but it's now there. The swamp also wasn't there 50 years ago. It was a pasture, a cropland, and now it's there. It's evolutive to some extent. So what baseline do you use? And what about mankind, of course? We also create nature. A lot of nature we see in Flanders is man-made. Pastures, also ecologically valuable pastures, are man-made. If you remove men and cattle, they will turn into a forest, ultimately. Most of them, at least. So it's interesting to see that there is no clear definition. If you take into account the recent case law, for instance, in Ecuador, you notice that rights of nature are mostly used in cases related to protected sites, which is some kind of a paradox because they're already protected. But still it helps to win these cases. So I'm not saying it's superfluous. But it gives rise to a lot of questions, because ultimately the attempt to define nature is already a bit contrary to what you might notice in Ecuador, that it's a holistic approach. It's no longer the divide between man and nature. It's a more indigenous view. We are part of nature. I'm the river. The river is me in New Zealand. But still, if you were to implement it, where do you stop? I'm not saying that we need to find an answer to this, but it will certainly, this question will pop up when you talk about recognizing rights of nature. Also invasive species, for instance, take the example of Brussels, where you have these parakeets. They're very noisy, so I guess everybody must have noticed them already. Is that part of nature? Who would say that this is nature? These parakeets, you like them? Some ecologists might say we should get rid of them because they're competing our woodpeckers out of the forest? Question mark. I mean, I'm not saying that it's the worst invasive species we have, but you have more clear-cut cases of invasive species. If you grant rights to nature, what happens with these invasive species? They're here because we brought them here. It's not that they came here because of climate change. Perhaps they're better suited to stay here now because the climate is warmer, but we brought them here. We released them accidentally or on purpose in the city, and now you see that you meet them everywhere, even in Lanaky. No, but I mean, they spread, of course, and they are adapted. The winter are no longer harsh, so they have no obstacles. And then, of course, the next question, which is also interesting, how do we interpret the notion of rights? This is what the property saw as this, the owner of the swamp saw as his right, the right to drain the swamp and to use it as a cropland. The very exclusive approach to property, yeah? This is my property, I have the usus and abusus. I can destroy nature on my property because it's my property, and I can, you have no access to my property. So what used to be a common was turned, accidental common I would say, turned into a more classic example of private property. And that's what's happening. So he tried to reopen the old drainage pipes to drain the area and make sure that it would no longer turn into a swamp. So the question is, what is the function of law? It's a language we created to provide legal certainty. We need contracts to have legal certainty. But how do we place human actors in this context? And of course, when you talk about granting rights to nature, often the counter-argument is raised, like, even when we talk about primates, monkeys, you have lawsuits which try to liberate monkeys and also to recognize their rights, and then often they are rejected in US courts because they state, like, okay, our society is built on a social contract, rights and duties, but monkeys have no duties. So they have no free will, they cannot determine to be part of the social compact. So that's an interesting question. But then again, I mean, there is also a theory that that you have rights and duties, so you have a claim, a legal right, when there is a corresponding duty. So if I conclude a contract with you, you say, I will give you this water, I write it down, so we have two corresponding claims. So you have the right to this water, and I have the duty to give it to you if we concluded an agreement in this regard. Of course, you could say that our environmental legislation, if they say that the swamp vegetation is protected, of course, or you cannot kill a wolf is a better example. I always use that example. In European environmental law, we say principally you cannot kill a wolf. Does the wolf has a right not to be killed? A right to life. If there would have been a protected species in the swamp would be its habitat. The species is protected. In vis-a-vis humans, we have then the duty to not interfere with the property of the species. We don't see it that way. We talk about the habitat. But what you basically are doing is saying the species has a property because it needs to survive. It needs to be able to have a burrow, habitat to feed itself, and so on and so forth. So then the question is, how do we approach nature in this regard? And you could also see it as a sliding scale, that you have primates, animals close to us, where they are conscious, they can express what they want. But of course, a swamp in itself, it's hard to notice what it wants. But still, when approaching nature, you could see it more as a kind rights as a reflection of a relationship, and we have a relationship with nature. And if you have if you reinterpret law as a more reflection of the relationships we're having with each other, with other fellow humans, but also with our environment, and of course we are forgotten that we have this relationship with our environment. But if we step above that, then we can still see law also as a contract with nature, not implying that nature has certain duties, but still that we have a kind of relationship with nature and that the law is a reflection of this relationship with nature. But of course, you could also ask yourself the following question: what does the swamp really want? Because it wasn't there and suddenly it popped up and then it was gone and then it reappeared. So what does it really want? So this is how the swamp looks now. This is a picture taken in the middle of the rectangular swamp. So I went there with a biologist and he was amazed that after 2 years, the rather endangered vegetation, I don't know the English word, zegevegetatie, which is not that very common in Flanders because we drain most of our swamps. 80% of our swamps are gone, or even more. So the swamp can reappear, but what does the swamp really want? Is that important to know when you grant rights to an ecosystem, to know what nature really wants? You, as I mentioned, there are attempts, of course, with primates and mammals. Mammals have consciousness to some extent. They can express. There is even a sense of justice with rats. They have already noticed that. They want their other. They want to be treated in a just manner, or they react. But of course, you can. The more you can start with very fellow other mammals, but then you have, what about fish? Do they have feelings? What about insects? We need to no longer eat cows, but should we turn to insects? Is that then a good thing? Because insects, they have less ability to feel pain, perhaps. Then, of course, you can go further and further, and then you end up with the ecosystem and the swamp itself. Nobody knows what the swamp wants. You could simply say the swamp doesn't mind to be drained anyway. It's humans that care in some ways. And then it becomes interesting again if you approach it from a relationship approach, that swamps are, and we forgot about that, they absorb CO2. They are CO2 sinks, so they are vital in the protection against climate change. If you get rid of all your swamps, you get rid of all your carbon sinks. They're the most effective carbon sinks we have, even better than plain forest. So it's about humans, ultimately, perhaps you could say. And then who will be the guardian of the swamp? At some point I was. there you see again the church tower. That's also a very complex question, because is it only an NGO who is capable of representing the swamp? Which, to some extent, we already accept, because NGOs can go to court when a wolf is illegally killed, when a company wants to cut down a forest. We accept in our current society that NGOs can step to court, even though the NGO is not the owner of the forest. We accept this already, but private citizens, that's something different, that you say that every citizen, who's even if he doesn't live there, can just go to court and say, well, no, I don't agree, this forest should stay there. Because that's what in Latin is framed as an actio popularis, that you represent a public good. And lawyers are very afraid of that because they fear that the floodgates will open and everybody will go to court. And what if some people prefer to see the swamp drained? Because to go back to the story in Lennik, why I was later told that some neighbors had complained about the wilderness that was next to their door. So accidentally they might have triggered him to consider, I'm going to get rid of all the vegetation and just return it into a cropland. So you have competing claims. You might have, for instance, me saying, I like this swamp. And another neighbor saying, well, no, you should get rid of the swamp. It's not how I see nature. You have competing claims. Of course, it depends also on the substantive rights you include in your law. If you write down in the legislation, as we did in Flanders, that principally swamps are protected, that's the end of the story to some extent. Then we as a society have accepted that this is important. And then another issue, and I, might again refer to, here you already see the result now, eh? The swamp is a rectangular swamp now, so he planted maïs surrounding in the area, so it was 1-3 hectares, and now 1.5 hectares is protected. This is the swamp, and he used the other area as a cropland to plant maïs, which is very clear. This I use it sometimes with my students as well to demonstrate how the legal system works. You have 1 centimeter, and then it's a swamp, and then the other centimeter is no longer protected and could do everything what you wanted. That's a classic property approach. You can do everything you want unless it's protected. But then, of course, balancing rights. But because, like, for instance, the example of Mussolini is also a very good example, because he probably also used the argument, but I got rid of the malaria. And I think in Italy, that still people will say, well, it's a good thing that we got rid of this swamp, because there was a lot of diseases in the swamp. So, and is it still sensible to bring back swamps with climate change? Because the mosquitoes and the malaria, I mean, they're of course also moving north with the warmer climate. So do we create new opportunities for diseases? And what about Brussels, by the way? It's also built on a swamp. Will we get rid of the city? Question mark. I mean, not saying. What we see in Brussels is that they try to reopen part of the Zenne River, that there is discussion on a swamp in Forêt, which was artificially created because it wasn't possibly not there originally, but as a result of human activities. So it's a difficult exercise, and I think again it's we humans that do the balancing. You could of course say if you don't protect swamps, ultimately nature will take revenge because climate change will be very have a very serious impact on us. But ultimately, granting rights to a swamp will include also a balancing act at some point. And you also see that in Ecuador, it's not because you grant rights to nature that every square meter of nature is absolutely protected. Human rights also are a balancing act. You can derogate from certain human rights under very specific circumstances. So we need to take that into account. So coming, well, in so, as a, as on a con- as a conclusion, you could say that if we talk about granting legal personality or rights to nature, it's basically about the recognition of a relationship, a contract. We have this fictitious idea of a social contract, but nobody here signed the social contract upon which our Western democracy is built. I didn't sign any social contract when I was born. You're just thrown into it. But still, this fictitious idea exists that we granted the power to the police power to the state. They will protect us. If they overstep their my rights, I can still go to court. When they set me in jail, I have the right to access to court in order to check whether my detention is lawful and so on and so forth. So there is this balancing act. And why not indeed imagining that we also have this ecological contract with nature? This is an idea from a French philosopher, Michel Serre. And rights of nature is basically, I think, a manifestation of that. But ultimately, it's a paradox, rights of nature, in two ways. It's a very Western concept of rights that tries to merge with the more holistic indigenous approach where humans are a part of nature. That's one of the paradoxes. But ultimately, it's also an anthropocentric notion. It's you could see it, and I rephrased a very famous quote of Churchill about democracy, like democracy is the worst form of government except for all others that have been tried. Perhaps you could say the same about granting rights to nature or recognizing rights of nature. It's not a quick fix. It's not the best solution, but it's ultimately what we are evolving towards. Because nowadays you can protect in Flanders a swamp that was unthinkable 30 years ago. We have discussions on livestock, the impact it has on habitats in Flanders. We have discussions about drainage activities, the impact it has on drought and so on and so forth. So we see there is, I think, a growing understanding that our existing environmental laws, which are very anthropocentric, they are mainly about human duties, that you can also reframe them if I do not have no right, if I cannot destroy a swamp, you could easily rephrase it and say, yeah, intrinsically swamps have also a right to exist in Flanders. And I think that would also benefit the debate if we accept it, but it will not be easy to accept that swamps can also be heroes, as I wrote this week in the newspaper. So it's in Dutch, but anyhow, those interested can still read it. So yeah, this was what I wanted to say. Thank you for your attention. Thank you very much.